Hey, what's up? This is Champagne Sharks, episode 005. Our guest today is Brandon Sutton from the podcast The Discourse. So strap in, enjoy. I think this was a good one. And with no further ado, let's get it. What's up? This is episode 005, and today we have Brandon, the creator and host of The Discourse, and I'm going to let him introduce himself.
Hey, thanks for, inviting me to be on your podcast, but I kind of invited myself.
Everyone doesn't have to know that. They don't have to know how the cookies are made. It's all good. But yeah, go on.
The expression is how the sausages are made. Everyone likes to watch cookies being made.
Actually, that's true.
The smell is lovely.
Yeah, people want to know how the cookies are made. Yeah, you're right. So Brandon, you were starting to tell me something that I thought was pretty interesting. We were talking about the UK elections and Corbyn and how a lot of liberals were freaking out, and you were starting to say something.
Well, I mean, again, I'm not going to pretend like I am mired in the minutia of parliamentary politics and I understand every little bit of how the UK election works, because I would just be disingenuous. But I think a big takeaway from it is the way that, you know, American U.S. liberals and Democrats and their line punditry have responded to the election of Corbyn, who is, you know, for lack of a better descriptor, a good analogy would be he was their Bernie, right? He was the
Bernie.
Even though he's a, you know, more or less to the left of Bernie in a lot of ways. And they just had a meltdown, a lot of them. Joan Walsh had a meltdown. Marcus H. Johnson, a.k.a. Smooth Cobra, had a meltdown.
Oh, yeah, I can imagine.
Smooth Cobra, who his name always reminds me. I don't know if you ever played Mega Man, like Mega Man X, but though, you know, Cyber Peacock. It's just like the boss robot at every level.
And you know, he is kind of like a cyber peacock, so that's pretty good. That's pretty good. But you know what you just said about him being further to the left of Bernie? If anything, that's just even more of an endorsement of the fact that Bernie could have worked. Because this guy is, you can't even say he was a toned down version. He was more explicitly left than Bernie was.
Oh, yeah. His manifesto, the Labour Party's manifesto, was incredibly deep and nuanced, and really the only attacks people to the right of him had of Corbyn were essentially, if you vote for him, he's going to do exactly what he said. If you vote for this, you know, this leftist politician, he is going to do everything he said. And, you know, that combined with all the disingenuous smears about him being a terrorist sympathizer because he wanted to acknowledge that foreign intervention played a role and terrorist attacks domestically.
I just love the idea that him being honest is what you need to be warned about. Like, that says so much about modern politics. Like how much lying is like baked into the equation? Like, you know, pardon the mixed metaphors, but yeah, it's like it's baked in. People expect dishonesty to the point that actually becomes a warning. Like, look, he's not just saying stuff to get elected. He's going to actually do it.
Yeah. He's not just saying he's going to help poor people. He's going to actually help them.
Yeah, like yeah, exactly. Like, it's amazing how expected and accepted it is that you're not supposed to be genuine.
But go back to your earlier question about him. Like, Bernie could have won. Bernie could have worked. Bernie could have done that. Let's ignore the fact that pretty much anyone could have beat Donald Trump. Like, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure I could have, you know, as campaign manager of a ham sandwich, could have gotten that ham sandwich elected president of the United States versus Donald Trump, you know, with $2 billion. I mean, mostly because I would have had Elizabeth Warren be the ham sandwich's vice president. But that's just that's my strategy. But this is not about whether or not Bernie could have beat Donald Trump. This is more about whether the establishment Democrats are allowed to define the acceptable boundaries of what is leftist politics in America. And that is really their priority, you know, like to be able to decide what is legitimate leftism and what is not. Because that's how they get their power. Like the Democratic establishment is like their big goal is to gatekeep leftism and popular discourse. Winning is secondary.
But you know, that's a big thing with the democratization of pop culture in general and the internet and how everything is decentralized. I mean, Occupy Wall Street, the bit, and Black Lives Matter, the big thing was about how decentralized and leaderless they are, but people don't realize how much everything is leaderless and decentralized. So hand in hand with what you said about the Democrats, you can say that for the Fox News Republicans, you can, you know, and their inability to gatekeep the alt-right, or you can look at the media and just how they can't set the agenda like they used to. That Donald Trump pussy grabbing story, the media would have been able to make that into just a stone cold silver bullet. They could have ended him right there. And I think people were so used to the media's old power, they assumed the media did end him with that. And lo and behold, people had their own filter bubbles, were on their own blogs, their own Facebook feed, and saying, fuck what the media is saying.
Oh, yeah, exactly. But like, but look at the media's response to that. Look at the mainstream media's response to that dynamic you've just described. It's, well, fake news, right? We have to, Theresa May, we have to police the internet. And like, of course, the excuse is because of terrorism, but like, it doesn't take Facebook or Reddit or Twitter to organize a terrorist attack. Like, it doesn't. Like, the internet is useful for organizing mass political movements and preventing, you know, media gaslighting.
Right now, I think what we're seeing with the center left and a bunch of other people in the media, too, which I include with the center left, is I think they're going through the 5 stages of grief, minus the 5th one, which is acceptance. They're just doing the first 4 over and over again, the cycle. It's just denial, anger, bargaining, depression, then right back to denial. Like they're just cycling, and they just can't jump to that 5th step of acceptance. And I think we saw that yesterday with that UK election. But stage 2, anger, like Joan Walsh really, really surprised me. Like did you see, like, she went at that guy from the New Republic? Is it Jeet here?
Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce his name, but I know it's Jeet here. And yeah, like that's what, because you're right, like that she's angry, and she's angry because, like you said, the media used to be able to construct a bubble, but in a lot of ways, Twitter and social media has been able to pop that bubble for them consistently.
Yeah, and civility is usually a big thing with those liberals. Like they either want to be very snarky at you or block you or just ignore you. And she was just straight up raging. Like, I was like, wow, like no incivility. Fuck the discourse. Fuck the West Wing.
Hey, my show. You can't
say No, it's been a guilty pleasure for me. I've watched 30 episodes of it like in a week. I was having, you ever watch something so much and binge it, you start having dreams about it?
No.
Oh no, that happened to me. Hamilton and the West Wing were on my mind like way more than they should.
Oh yeah, the West Wing, that's another one of Aaron Sorkin shows, the West Wing, yeah. The Newsroom, and it comes across as just these liberal fan fictions, like liberal fantasy about what they think politics should look like. And it's
I think they live their lives like fan fiction. I think they actually just walk around. Yeah, and they think like everyone else is like a supporting player. I mean, I feel like that's what gentrification is like. Like people move into my building, and you know, I think in their mind, like, I'm that quirky black neighbor who they see by the mailbox. Like I think their lives are fan fiction. I think they have these really weird self-constructed visions of, like, they come into my building. Like, let me tell you the story. My neighbor is a black guy. He went to Columbia Law School, and I think he was even like a professor a little bit, but I don't know his full story. Plus, I don't want to blow up his spot. But, you know, he's a black guy. He has his family. Some 20-something-year-old white girl moved into his building, and they keep raising the rents on that building. And he came in with all his Costco stuff, with a station wagon, with his family. And the first thing the girl said, she goes, "Are you our delivery guy?" With all his groceries and everything, his family. Like, that was her first thing to say to him. And she was basically trying to find out if he belonged in the building.
Well, of course, right? Their lives, or rather, that's part of the white supremacy, right? Like, they frame the world that's revolving around them. It's I always think about it this way, like, minorities to white people domestically and abroad kind of lack object permanency. Like, yes. they don't exist until they're there.
And that's it's called, was it solipsism?
It's egocentrism. I think so. Like, solipsism.
I read, I have no idea the correct way to pronounce that, so don't imitate me. I was probably butchered it, but
I think solipsism refers to, like, yeah, the philosophy that the world does not exist outside of your own personal, it's the idea that the world is not real. It's kind of like Matrix-y in that way. The world is not real. You're the only thing that's real in the world. And that's you can only be sure that you're real by nature of you being you. I'm obviously butchering the explanation, but it's very, very, like, that's the far, far end of narcissism and egocentrism. It's just like,
yeah, that's what I thought it was. That's what I meant to use. Like, I think sometimes they think black people stop existing once they're out of the frame.
Oh, yeah. Or they just come into existence, and then they have to figure out how they relate to them. And
yes.
It's usually as a subordinate role. It's like they can't be my neighbor, my equal, my peer. Like, if they're here in my sort of world, then it must be temporary, or it must be subordinate, and basically they can't be in any way sort of above me or have been here before me. Like, you know, like, the Native Americans didn't exist until white people came, until Columbus came here.
And I think there's like a, you know, that Bechdel test that they have for women?
The Bechdel, that test is not typically very good.
Yeah, yeah. But I feel like there is something of that for non-white people, as in, it's hard for them to fathom black people either talking about something at length and carrying on that doesn't censor white people at all, or the idea of black people not waiting for white people to show up. You know, like I was watching Moonlight and Precious, and I feel like even though those movies had little to no white people in them, there was an unconscious sentiment, we're waiting for them to show up and save them.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
they were present by their absence. Like, their absence was like the elephant in the room. Like, if some white person could get in here, this could be fixed.
I see that. And I think that comes down to what the movie is marketed towards, and the kind of idea that it has to still, like, there can be no, or rather, let me rephrase that. The old idea that you can't really have media that's aimed at black people or people of color and have it be broadly successful, because then, you know, white people can't empathize. Right.
Yeah.
They can't empathize. I think we're seeing that now, too. When you talk about, like, the new global phenomenon of movies, you're seeing China being centered in a lot of movies. Like, that's why in the last Transformers movie, a big portion of it takes place in China. It's just, like, for no reason. I think, like, a lot of these are reflecting, like, economic values.
Because China's bringing that box office now.
Yeah. So you got to put the movie in China. You got to throw in some Chinese roles for, like, famous Chinese actors. You got to do what you got to do.
And China even saves franchises now. They have some franchises. Like, I believe the last XXX did okay in America. And I remember hearing that the China box office alone put it so over the edge that it might warrant a sequel after all, despite having a lukewarm U.S. box office that normally would have put it in doubt.
I love the last XXX. I love trash movies. I love trash media.
I keep meaning to see it, but I haven't gotten around to. Wait, here's how we know how much you like trash media. Did you like Fast 8?
I haven't seen it yet, but when we finish this, I am going to go watch it. I literally just got a copy of it. I'm like, oh, that's my night tonight.
Oh man, I wish I waited. I like Fast 8, but that one, I was a little underwhelmed, man. I don't know.
I like all of them. Like, I don't know. I don't even like Cars.
But it has nothing to do with Cars. That thing is like, right now it's a superhero franchise. The cars might as well be planes. They might as well be whatever. There's no physics involved. Those things could be spaceships. They could be drones. Those things are driving right now. Those are not cars.
It could be, but I feel like it's car porn, right? Or rather, I don't know. I feel like if it was actually car porn, there would be more attention paid to, like, the actual mechanics of cars. So it's like soft core car porn. Because, like, hardcore car porn would be like, well, my engine is X, Y, and Z. And I think there was a little bit of that in the earlier part of the franchise.
I think the first one, they were trying to be that. And then afterward, they were just like, you know what? Fuck it. This is the Avengers, but in cars.
Exactly.
It's fine. This is wacky races, but, like, with bikini tops and stuff.
Mario Kart.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I'm fine.
There's no shame in my game. I'm fine with that. Just, like, asses in, I don't know, what's a car thing? Transmission?
Oh man, you really don't know about cars.
I don't know. I grew up in New York City. I don't know anything about cars.
Oh man, man. Yeah, wait, but you know what? Before we even move on, talk about your podcast, because I want to give you a chance to talk about the discourse and what your mission statement is, and you know what it's about.
Oh my God, that's a lot.
I put you on the spot.
A mission statement. Oh my God. My podcast is really just a vehicle for me to talk to people about things that are on my mind and to, you know, get people who are famous or semi-famous to sit down and speak to me without it being awkward. People who are famous on Twitter without having to go, hey, I'm a fan of your work. Would you just be willing to sit down with me on Skype and talk for 90 minutes?
And how's that been working?
Oh, it works out great. I mean, like, the easiest way to get people to follow you on Twitter is to shitpost. And so, like, I am skilled at Twitter bullying and shitposting. So.
Oh. Well, wait, what's your handle? Let the people know.
Oh, my handle on Twitter is @prettybadlefty. Pretty and then bad and then lefty, but with a Y, not an I-E.
Wait, so what's some of the, like, shitposting's broad, like what's shitposting
for me is just like harassing people who work for MSNBC and other mainstream liberals.
Oh, that's a good call. Oh, so yeah, okay, I'm on the same page then.
Okay, I mean, it's not shitposting to me, it's a public service to me and probably you, but yeah, like to no. them it's like these are trolls and Bernie bros and and misogynist Russian cyborgs.
But you know what's so weird about liberals on Twitter is they're really, really bad at it, but they can't stop. I don't understand like why they just don't give up. Like they get very hyperventilating and I mean, they're just really, really bad on it, but they just stay on and hang in there and just keep trying.
Well, I wish it was masochism because that'd be kind of like cool or like I can understand that. But really what it is goes back to our first conversation, which is that they're just used to having dominance over the media. Like they're just used to being, and you know, they talk about the media being liberal or conservative, but really what it is mostly upper middle class white people or like analogs of upper middle class white people. So like upper middle class people of color who, you know, went to the same schools, who it's not just a big homogenous slice of society.
Yeah, and the black professional managerial class of liberals are pretty indistinguishable from the white ones when it comes to like a lot of the core behaviors, you know, because I mean, like, for example, what happened with Dyson recently with Bill Maher. Oh,
God.
And Donna Brazile. I mean, there's no... Like, people are getting excited, like, they're going to have these people on Bill Maher this week. And I'm like, what are they going to say different than Al Franken would say? You know, I mean...
Well, I think the black liberal class, the Negro liberal class, like, they maintain their power by gatekeeping blackness and racism in the mainstream, by defining it and allowing the liberal elites to, you know, have their black friends. It's like, it's the job of the black elite class to, you know, not infiltrate, but to represent all blackness and all black people. And so that they can erase the plurality of black people, co-opt all of their narratives and struggles, and use those, you know, use that power to further the neoliberal agenda. Like, that's what they do, and they leverage that ability for power.
But right now, the quote-unquote typical black writer they have in the mainstream media is narrower than I've ever seen it. It's mind-blowing to me how the people, I mean, the gatekeeping is really nuts now. It's always just a very, very narrow version of intersectional feminism, but it's not even like the academic version. It's a very consumerist, neoliberal, Tumblr-ish version.
Ooh, Tumblr. You know, I've never, people always bring up Tumblr when they say stuff like that, but I've only ever seen like cats and porn on Tumblr. I don't really know what people refer to.
Oh man, I guess the same way you have like a classic liberalism is like a classic Tumblrism, that even though Tumblr is not really that anymore, like a couple of years ago, Tumblr was the epitome of this. And it's kind of stuck with Tumblr. Like right now you have alt-right Tumblr, cat Tumblr, porn Tumblr, it's all over the place. But I feel like the classic Tumblr is like a bad Dominica, what's the other girl, Trudes, like that type of pure, always angry, bell hooks reading feminist kind of.
Okay, I think I get what you're saying. I think so. Basically, the stereotypes that people always attribute to the left.
Yes, but it's like it's very identity politics oriented, but it's also. Like, for example, did you see when all those people got mad at bell hooks?
When she was making fun of Beyonce because she was salty?
Yeah. But she was making fun of Beyonce. And I'm not even saying bell hooks was right or wrong. But her stance was totally consistent to me with what bell hooks always says. Like, she has these weird problems with consumerist and, you know, sexualized type of commerce. So, to me, what she said was perfectly in line with what bell hooks has always written about. But a lot of this crowd was flying off the handle, like bell hooks is some kind of betrayal. And I'm like, okay, either you agree with her or you disagree with her. If you disagree with her, either ignore her or engage what she's saying. But instead, people were just like, oh my God, bell hooks, what are you doing? What is... So, like, I just feel like it's all etiquette. There's no real...
Okay, so I think I get what you're saying. And, you know, just to speak to the bell hook thing, I would only say my only issue with her stance was that it was inconsistent in the way she treated Emma Watson. And
that I agree with.
And what it seemed to be, whether you're talking about Emma Watson or bell hooks, there seems to be some sort of... She feels there needs to be fealty paid in all forms of feminism to academic feminism. And if you can master that language of the Emma Watsons, of the bell hooks, of the Judith Butlers, of the Haraways, of the Frasers, of the, you know, Adichie, Chimamandas, then you get a blank pass to, you know, like if you basically sophistry, like if you can master the elite academic feminism, you get to gatekeep what it means to be a feminist or a woman or anything. Same with anti-racism. Like if you're a Michael Eric Dyson or Cornel West who am I thinking of also, Mark Lamont Hill, any of these people who have mastered the language of intersectionality, of third wave feminism, of critical race theory, of all these things, then you're allowed to gatekeep it, or rather not only gatekeep feminism or anti-racism, but the entire black or female experience. So I mean that
no totally
so I mean my but you know this move past that I think with the problem with intersectionality is that it no longer means intersectional. What it means is that
exactly
it's the weaponization of atomized identities to the like to the detriment of the other ones, right? So it's not saying, well, here intersectionality is the idea that everyone is a confluence or an assemblage of various identities, you know, poor, black, male, you know, hetero, trans, all these other things, and then different social situations, power emerges differently. Like where you might be in a situation where as a black male, you're with all black females, and you're at the highest of the high in that particular social situation. You might be in another situation where you're surrounded by white women, and you're beneath them, and like it's that idea. But instead, what we have is that, oh, okay, you're black. Forget everything else about you. You know, if you're allowed to speak for all black people. And that's like the opposite of it.
And I think that's one of the problems with how intersectionality gets defined on Twitter, because when you read a lot of the original intersectionality talk, it was about what you said, race, gender, class, sexuality. They took the class out of it and just focused on all the different identities. So it became this weird kind of... It's like Dragon Ball Z and like power levels. It's like, okay, here's six identities.
Oppression.
And let's just rank. Yeah. Let's just rank, you know, which ones are top and which ones are the bottom. And then this is a new etiquette we have to follow. So there was this article, I think it was on bustle.com or one of those sites. It was how to tell if your feminism is intersectional. And then the article, all it did was just list different identities. Are you gay? Okay, check. What race are you? Check. What gender? Do you recognize, if you're white, you recognize your privilege? And so basically, all it was an intersection of different identities instead of an intersection of identity, class, and, you know, other things. They just made it into, let's make sure we have all the identities, a perfect taxonomy of every identity and a perfect ranking system.
Well, yeah. I mean, but the thing is, like, everyone's intersectional. It's like that's the thing.
Yeah.
But I think that's sort of gotten lost in the shuffle, right? Everyone's intersectional. A big part of identity is not essential or biological. It's performative and social. It's constructed socially. And all these things that have kind of gotten lost in this weaponization of identity politics that goes on with the Democratic Party, where what they want to do is they want to take a rich white woman and a rich black man and put them at the front of the party and say, look how diverse we are, while simultaneously like pushing black women to the side, pushing, you know, poor people to the side, pushing anyone who doesn't fit into, like, let's be honest, like, you know, liberals and Democrats, they have their preferred minorities, and they tend to be the black man and the white woman. And that's what they tout out to critique the right for their racism and sexism. And then they act as a veil to the racism and sexism within the Democratic Party, and even the more complicated forms of isms.
See, I disagree with you on one thing there. And right now, I think the black woman is more in vogue than the black man. And... like, if you just look... Have you seen some of the recent... like Lena Dunham had some kind of post, and she was saying, I had a dream.
Oh God.
And in this, actually, you know what? Let me not even butcher it, because I have to get it right. It's pretty weird, but, okay. After this, it was about Solange being president. Did you ever see this one?
No, please explain it to me.
You know what? I have to, find it. Hopefully she didn't, delete it, but she was basically saying that she had a dream that something happened to Trump and they needed the next president, and she looked around and there was Solange, and she grabbed her and said, I found her, the next president. And then, you know, this whole anti-Maxine thing where these white liberals are turning Maxine Waters into the black auntie, you know, and they're calling her Auntie Maxine. But they're not black. Like, it's different than when black people call her Auntie Maxine. It's like they're inviting themselves to the cookout, which I think is a played out term. But I feel like right now, like, black women are what people are saying is going to save them.
I get that. And I think that where I differ for you in that position is that I think that when we talk about atomized identities, when it comes time for someone to speak for women, we get white women. And when it comes time for someone to speak for black people, we get black men. So oftentimes, I think that, you know, speaking of truths, I think she's the one who came up with the term misogynoir. By nature of black women having less social capital and also material capital than white women or black males, they often kind of get erased from that picture. But I agree with you, actually, now you're saying that. I think that black women are a lot more in vogue now. And I think that, again, that has its own problems, because the Auntie Maxine thing,
of course,
has that weird tinge of the other and the weird tinge of, like, the mammy, like, you know, the older black lady is going to, you know, save us.
And also the magical Negro. I think there's a lot of that in there, for sure.
Definitely.
You know, I mean, like, there's even that term, black girls are magic. And I feel like people are trying to reclaim it as a positive thing, you know, as something to give self-esteem. But I think for a lot of people, like, have you seen those Clara Jeffrey tweets where she's, like, talking about, like, these black women, like, I wish this black woman was right here, this protest now to stop these cops. Do you know the exchange I'm talking about? It's really...
No, I don't, but I think I remember it, like, as though it were a fever dream, because it sounds like something that I recall, but I might have blocked it out because it was traumatic.
Oh, yeah. People kept trying to say, like, listen, this is a human being. What are you doing? And you know, on Twitter, the shrillest... I forget his real name, but he goes by the Shrillest on Twitter. He was trying to explain to her exactly why it's not cool, and she just wasn't getting it. She kept digging deeper. She was like, but I was just trying to say that she has superpowers.
I know your first episode, you talked about third one about Hamilton. You talked about Get Out, right? And yeah. I wrote an article about Get Out and how it really, really Get Out addresses this exact same dynamic you're talking about right now. What people don't realize is that idolization is not the same thing as humanizing somebody. In fact, it's another form of dehumanizing.
Exactly.
So with the movie Get Out, you don't see the normal kind of racism you normally see when you talk about movies, where it's like, oh, it's the, I mean, it's still otherizing, right? But it's the debasing of blackness. Instead, you see the idolizing of it, and it tries to get the point across that that's just as dangerous, because it also doesn't engender empathy. And, you know, that, you know, this also explains how people can be in favor of black athletes or black movie stars, but still not have empathy for black people or the lives of black people, because idolization just doesn't do that. Like, you're still, it's still dehumanizing.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the old, Negrophilia. I actually got a book in the mail today. It's actually about this. It's
reading.
Yeah. Oh, the book is actually called Negrophilia, and it's just about how in the 20s, like, black people were the vogue in France and Paris. And the whole idea was, among these elites, that black people had this soul to them, this realness. You know, it was the preferred way to slum. It was. You know, like, that type of magic to them. And that's why Josephine Baker was so huge. And a lot of black people, you know, relocated over there, and everybody just couldn't get enough of the whole African thing. Like, whether you were James Baldwin or Josephine Baker, you were both considered to have a higher spirituality, but you were also no different than a tribal person. Like, you know, you had that, like, even though you're James Baldwin and you're incredibly erudite, and, like, James Baldwin talks extemporaneously, like most people wish they could write after four drafts. And he just comes off the dome like that. It's amazing.
If I could speak like James Baldwin, I wouldn't have a podcast. I'd have, well, I wouldn't have anything because they would probably assassinate me. But but you know what?
Oh my god! I wish I could write like he speaks. Like, you know, he just speaks like he just wrote five drafts in his head on the spot. It's amazing. But they were looking at him basically like he was just like the wise giant in Green Mile. You know, like he was still considered a link to the primitive, even though they were dazzled by his intellect. You know what I mean? He still was that too.
Definitely. The idea that black people, by nature of being black, are closer to nature, are closer to, like, you know, that dichotomy between man-made and nature, and that black people, black women specifically, like, exist closer to nature, closer to the spiritual world than white people do by nature, you know, by nature of their skin and their race.
Yeah, and that's the reason why I think right now black women are it. Like black women, I think right now have a lot more social capital than people are giving them credit for. And you see, like, okay, you look at this anti-Maxine thing, and just people are just going crazy. They're wearing Maxine Waters t-shirts. I mean, I'm waiting for white people to start speaking in tongues. Like, you know, she's gonna lay hands on them, and just some white liberals gonna flip out.
Today.
yeah. But it's like you see her, but when it's time to like have an actual intellectual addressing of Trump, she's not the politician they're gonna go to. If they want like some neck roll or some kind of sass, they're going to talk to her. But, you know, if it's time to actually have a in-depth substantive policy talk, I notice they don't really engage her in that level to the same degree. They'll have someone else come on. And I just find it vaguely insulting. It just unnerves me, the whole anti-Maxine thing.
I mean, I don't know how much of it is her actually trying to use that to her own, because then the question becomes, like, is she trying to use that dynamic? Is she trying to leverage that Auntie Maxine and, you know, black kind of negrophilia for political capital, you know, to try to take over the party from, say, Nancy Pelosi, who they do go to for that kind of thing.
Exactly. And let me just make clear, I'm not disrespecting the elder and trying to say I think she's cynically. I have no position, no way to know if she's doing this on purpose, if she's being opportunistic. I'm not even going there. I'm just saying that whether it's intentional or not, this is the kind of theater I'm seeing. And I just find it really kind of creepy, like, to hear podcasts by these white wine moms in Park Slope talking about Auntie Maxine and how, you know, she read somebody, you know, using slang. I'm like, oh, this is just really creepy.
Oh my gosh, what she got? She threw shade on somebody?
Oh yeah, yeah. Oh my god, that's not even black slang anymore. That's just basically.
I missed that whole thing.
Shade is theirs now. They've
stolen shade. We can't have anything. Oh well, I was at a party in Bushwick with a bunch of Dominican people, and they pulled out crystals and started doing crystal magic. So, I mean, that's exactly what I thought. I was like, oh my gosh, like we've taken golf and now we've taken crystal magic. White people don't have nothing anymore. Soon we'll be playing hockey, and they'll have some real trouble coping with that white fragility. But I mean, just to go off that, I think that, you know, the other side of that too, you know, not looking sort of internally to the black community, is, you know, talk about James Baldwin, is this notion, or rather this myth that is perpetrated by, you know, black liberals, that they have some kind of claim to the black radical tradition just because they're black. Like, you'll have black, you know, liberals go out there and sort of quote Malcolm X or Martin King Jr. or James Baldwin or Angela Davis, and they'll do it to push forth a corporate agenda. And it's just like, Cory Booker quotes Angela Davis all the time. It's just like, she doesn't like you. Keep her name out of your mouth.
I was surprised. I just started reading Franz Fanon, and it's something people kept telling me to read. I never got around to it. And one of the reasons why I never got around to it was because black liberals kept mentioning they read him. So then I would think, okay, if so-and-so, I'm not going to name names, likes Fanon, he must be, you know, very, you know, middle of the road. What? When I finally read Fanon, I was like, wait a minute, how does X, Y, and Z in black media read Fanon? Like, in Obama's autobiography, he talks about reading Fanon up and down.
He probably has.
Because I... Yeah, he has. But it goes to what you say. They can invoke these names. They might even have read them. And it makes you wonder, like, what still sticks of it with them? Like, I would have no idea reading what I've read from Fanon so far. He must have been pretty into some radical stuff at his day. Like, he's been exposed to the theories.
Yeah, I mean, what sticks with him is the language. And this is what Harry Belafonte called him on back in 2005, I think, where it was just like, by nature of Barack Obama's mastering the language of the radical spirit, the radical movement of the civil rights movement, and also being black, he tried to lay claim to that, the underlying, mastering the radical language and using his blackness to give the illusion that he has some sort of claim to it. He was able to, you know, leverage that to pretend like he was embodying that spirit, when really he was not. He just mastered the language, and that's what makes, I guess, you know, liberals, as Malcolm X said, dangerous, because they've mastered the language. They've mastered the language of trying to help the marginalized people, but they don't really, beneath that, it's quite vapid. It's a vacuous performance on their part.
What did you think of Dyson's letter in response to Bill Maher?
I'm so tired of everyone and Bill goddamn Maher. Bill Maher, I tweeted out, like, Bill Maher has been a piece of shit for over a decade now. Bill Maher,
a while.
Yeah, Bill Maher has been a proponent of Islamophobia. He's used the idea that Islam is some kind of inherently demonic or deviant religion to justify torture, more or less. He has used wife beating analogies. You know, he's done all of these things, and we have to go through these cycles of getting enraged at him. He apologizes, or we don't apologize, or one of his more leftist friends caped for him. I was tired of him when I was 20. And so Dyson coming out and saying this nonsense right now is ridiculous. I was like, when Jeremy Scahill came out and finally admonished him when he brought on Milo, I was like, it's too late for Jeremy Scahill. I was like, if you were still on his show in 2017, if you were still on the Bill Maher train in 2017, you're a piece of shit too. I mean, you need to reevaluate your life decisions, because you were obviously special pleading for him because you thought he was on quote unquote your side.
And then people who still fucked with him after Milo,
like
at that point, what does it care if he's saying nigger? Like, you know what I mean? Once he has that guy on, he's already calling you a nigger. Yeah. Like, you know,
Milo's dangerous. Like, Milo is, he's not just using words at that point. Milo is not just giving thought experiments. He's like, he's outing trans people. He's outing undocumented workers. He's actually a danger to people. And it's still treated as though it's some kind of game for ratings. And that's why Bill Maher has the power to do this, right? Because he can platform people. Like, sans for that, he'd be off, like, people wouldn't defend him. But because he can, you know, he can bring you on to promote your book, he can bring you on to, like, promote your whatever new endeavor you're on, he has power. And so people will cape for him.
And Yvette Carnell, I know you said that you don't listen to Yvette Carnell, but she discussed recently, she was talking about how Bill Maher really kind of shows the impotence of the black professional managerial class and the black punditry and the black politicians, because so far I've seen a bunch of people either not speak out against him or they actually cape for him. And when you look at the list, it's all black people who've been on the show before. And it's like, yes, you're a comedian, you're an entertainer, but we need you more than you need to fear us. It really shows how kind of impotent our black professional managerial class is. Now, what I'm wondering is it just about the black professional managerial class, or is it just the professional managerial class in general? If it was a white liberal, if it was white liberals that were mad at him, like, how do you think it would have went? If it was something that he did to offend them?
I mean, I think they're, just to answer your question first, the foreground, I think they're all craven, but we expect more solidarity from black people. I think that by nature of blackness as being, we consider it generally to blackness to be a social thing, like, you know, there to be solidarity amongst black people. It's a bigger grievance. We don't expect that kind of solidarity amongst white people for good reason. And when it is, they tend to be white nationalists. And that's, yeah, like that's why we can't have, you know, whites only clubs, because like that's just not the way things go. But do I think if he did something to aggrieve white liberals, I don't know what that would really be. I mean, like he said the N-word. He's, you know, talked about how Hamas is like a woman you have to slap. He's, you know, brought on Milo, who has offended trans people. Like, the only thing that, like, I don't, like, what does it take to offend white liberals? What does it take to?
I have a feeling it would be something to do with Hillary. I feel like,
yeah,
there's probably some line that you would cross with Hillary that I think would make them, flip. But then again, you know what? He probably would never even push that line to begin with if he knew it was going to offend mainstream white liberals. So
I mean, I think white liberals, they focus a lot on language, right? I think the N-word thing offended white people a lot more than they offended black people, because they hyper focus on microaggressions and language as being the only legitimate forms of racism or sexism or misogyny. But at the same time, with people like Bill Maher or Milo or Richard Spencer, any of you, like, you know, forget the ideology, but like they treat them like kind of they're the voyeuristic aspect to it. There's a voyeurism to it, and they like that stuff. They like they like to flirt with that kind of racism. They like to flirt with that kind of misogyny and then pull back.
Well, I think one of the biggest rushes that a white guy, especially in America, can get, and I think liberals have this, is I think there's this idea of being able to say and do things around black people that other white people can't. And I feel like Bill Maher is the embodiment of that. Like, you know, the guy who can say things that, hey, if most white people say this, they would get punched in the face. But this guy is such an honorary black guy. He has so much swag or so cool that he's one of the fellas. He can say it. And I think the ultimate embodiment of that is being able to say nigger.
Oh, yeah.
You know, because even Eminem can't say that. Eminem is probably as down as you can get in hip hop, and he still can't drop an N bomb in the middle of a rap.
I mean, he's no riff raff, but I agree. But I think I don't know about your analysis, but I definitely think they're white people are so aggrieved by the fact that they can't say the N word. They are so aggrieved by the fact that they can't say nigger in public.
It drives them
crazy for some reason. And the reason, and again, that comes down to white privilege and entitlement. Like, they don't like that there's something that they're not allowed to do socially. Like, there's no legal ramification for saying the N word. Like, you know, like, you might get your ass kicked, but like, there's no legal ramification for it. Like, you would just be shunned. And like, it's the one thing they can't do. And you can hear it, because every time, like, but rappers say it, it's like,
but you know the thing, there's a lot of things socially white people can't do. I think I think one thing that makes nigger worse is that they're being kept from doing it by black people. I think that's the part. Like, if it was just coming from white people, you know, it'd be one thing. Like, you know, but I think what bothers them is that not just that they can't say it, but that black people can say it. And it's black people who are really doing more of the explicit forbidding. I think it's those two things. For example, if it was white people saying, you can't say nigger, and that goes for you too, Blackie, they'd be like, you know, hey, it's okay. We're all being banned from it. You know, and we're being banned by a white person from saying
it. Oh, yeah.
It bothers them to me that black people are the one enforcing this ban, and they're reserving, to the degree that it's a privilege, you know, I don't think it's a privilege, but to the degree that it's a privilege, like, how dare they first tell us what to do and then reserve it for themselves?
Yeah, like, it's a double standard. They don't like that double standard. Yeah. That there's something that we can do, even though it's like, even though we can't even vote in America, like, without being harassed. It's like, they don't like that something that we can do that they can't do. And really, we're the gatekeepers of that. And like, it frustrates them. I don't know why. I can't do a lot of stuff, but they're just not used to it, I think.
I have this theory that I'm currently thinking about. And have you heard about the I think everyone knows about this, but I'm late to it. The singularity and how there's this point where artificial intelligence is going to take over or something. Is that how it goes?
I don't think that's actually true. There's a book by an AI theorist that contradicts this and has to do with inputs and outputs in a computer system. But yeah, the singularity is a science fiction idea or term, as it was derived from one, that there's a point in which a computer realizes an AI system becomes as smart as man does and then never goes back and realizes that it's better or something. And they know that's Skynet, basically.
Yeah. I feel like white people are afraid of a Negro Larry. there's going to be this tipping point of blackness that you're never going to be able to come back from. And I feel like there's different ways of reacting to it, and some people have just surrendered to it. I think the white genocide, that's a rebellion against it. Like they're fighting it by being, we're going to overcompensate against it. We're going to retreat deeper into whiteness. We're going to be extra white. We're going to try to purge ourselves of all black.
And I feel mayonnaise on everything.
Yep. And I feel like in liberal circles, they're like, you know what? We're going to have insurance policy. We want to be able, we're going to surrender to it to a degree, but let's see to what degree we can control it. What can we do to make the Negrolarity, if it is inevitable, how can we adapt to it? How can we function? And I feel like this obsession with black women right now is people are like, okay, if I'm going to have to be a nigger, who is the best survivor in the black community? Who's going to teach me how to survive? And I think that's where these black women are coming in. Trump right now, you see people freaking out. And to me, they're freaking out because they're like, holy shit, we're going to become niggers too under Trump.
Oh, yeah.
And we need a spirit guide to teach us how to survive in, the Negrolarity. And they think, okay, black women, they're not physically strong, they get it from all angles. And if they can survive and thrive, they must be the ones that hold the answer for us living under Trump. I think that Negrolarity is, everyone's responding to it in different ways and freaking out about it. Their fantasies are just insane. People are thinking they're going to be in this new third world.
Oh yeah. And I mean, you said a lot that deserves to be unpacked, but yeah, that's what the whole white genocide thing is. It's the demographic war that eventually one day the majority of America will be brown people. And that, and the white genocide thing is a way to reframe white supremacy as being the victim of something. It's the same way, stuff like affirmative action is reframing as, stuff is being taken away from me. I gotta be our dominance is being taken away. And when it comes down to that's what their focus on miscegenation is, right? There's race mixing going on. There's gonna be less white people. Who cares though? It's just who cares?
And I think liberals are trapped in that same cycle, but they don't even see it. They've just chosen a different response to it. Instead of trying to fight against it, these alt-right people, they're like Don Quixote, and they're trying to joust against windmills. And I think these liberals are like, you know what? That's a hell of an uphill battle. We're just going to just adapt and try to at least control the outcome. The Negrolarity will be here, but at least we're going to define it and have it under, so they're designating who the black public intellectuals are, who, they're trying to study black women and buy full-fledged into it. I mean, I think liberals believe in white genocide to a certain degree too. They've just decided, hey, we're just gonna ride the wave. We're gonna ride it. We'll intermarry. We'll do whatever we have to do.
I mean, I think they still just don't realize, and this is classic in-group out-group stuff. They don't realize that the black community is not one homogenous thing. It's like that there still seems to be this denial that black people are not just one block of people who have the same culture, who have the same, who all like each other, who all identify as one thing. Of course, there are some, you know, there are some things that cross-sect all blackness, you know, domestic and global. And once you get to the global level, it's even harder to come across. But, you know, like it's just like they just have no. White people and people outside of the black community have no understanding that all black people are not the same and don't view, not only are they not the same, they just don't view themselves as the same. And you always hear when have you ever had someone when you're arguing with them about, I don't know, your leftism, quote another black person to you, and you're like, I don't care what Ta-Nehisi Coates thinks.
Yeah, oh my God, they do it all the time, and it's very interesting because sometimes I wonder if it's that they don't understand it or they don't want to accept it, you know, because, for example, you ever see all those liberals who try to paint Bernie Bros as, you know, it's all white and male, and then there'll be a bunch of people of color responding like, hey, I'm a Bernie supporter, and say it's like Jessica Valenti or one of those or Joan Walsh, they'll respond to everybody but the black people and the women chiming in. They might occasionally respond to the woman if it's a white woman to tell her that she internalized misogyny. So to me, even if you're picking at random, just by averages and probability, you would occasionally respond to a black person, you know, but if you're responding to everyone but the black person, you're conscious of
that. Oh, I mean, I don't know. I think it just goes down to that quote from, I don't know if you read comic books, but there's a quote from the Crisis crossover in DC, Identity Crisis, where...
That's a deep cut.
Where, like, they're whispering near Superman, and one of them, like, it was maybe Green Arrow and somebody, and the guy says, can't Superman hear us? He's like, oh, no, Superman only hears what he wants to hear. And, you know, like, people are closed-minded. You talk about neuroses, like, cognitive dissonance is a hell of a drug. And you can really close yourself off to it. When it comes down to the Bernie Bro phenomenon, I wrote a piece about liberal homophobia. And, you know, I addressed that in this piece. And you can find the piece over at theprogressivearmy.com under my name, Brandon.
Good plug.
I'm getting better at this. And it comes down.
Yeah, get it.
A good part of the power that liberals have come from their ability to weaponize marginalized people's identities in the mainstream media versus conservatives. And in order to do that, they have to have domination over those identities. There can't be any dissent between black people on the left. There can't be any dissent between women on the left, unless they, again, they can sort of frame that dissent as, you know, white women, you know, internalizing misogyny, black people internalizing white supremacy. And so if you do contradict the mainstream liberal point and you happen to be a person of color woman, they just erase you from the conversation because they can't deal with
it. See, but that's what I'm saying. I don't think it's that they don't know that there's different black voices. They don't want to accept it. See, I agree with you there. They need it to be a united voice. So I think I'm not so sure if it's that they don't know or if it's that, yes, they know, but they can't let it be a thing because it goes against what they need.
It helps them homogenize the opposition, right? And that strengthens them. So, like, they're able to, if you talk about class, you know, you try to have a sort of a socialist or class analysis, a material analysis of society, or even a systemic or structural one of society. They're able to paint that critique as a white male vanity project. Like, oh, black people aren't interested in that. Black people only care about, you know, affirmative action and having more black faces in high places. Women don't care about that. They don't care about the $15 minimum wage. They care about closing the gender wage gap. You know, like that.
Yeah, everyone wants to lean in. That's all women care about.
I know, but we're almost running out of time. And since we're talking about liberals and racism, you promised that I would get to hear about your perception of the Hillary Clinton renting slaves thing.
Yes. See, you know, it's funny because I saw we were closing up, and I was going to ask you your last thoughts, and you flipped it on me, and you asked me mine. Okay, so, you know what's crazy about that thing was that it was out in the public all this time, and nobody pounced on it. And I was thinking maybe even if Donald Trump knew, maybe he couldn't pounce on it because maybe his fans would actually like that about her. Like, wait a minute, she owns slaves?
She rented them. God, why are you being so reductionist? Yeah. Don't miss.
Yeah, I know. She rented
them for 10 years from the state. I mean, if it were a rent-a-center, she would have probably been able to buy them. You know, lease to buy, but unfortunately I don't think she had that option in the, you know, in her contract with them. So, you know, get it right. I know it's your show, but you can't be reductionist.
No, I have to get the legal terms of art correct. But what was the most notable thing to you about
I honestly
that?
Was not as bothered by her. Okay, well, first, I don't know. I don't know how people missed this. I guess because the book isn't very good. It was probably like on page 3. And no one got that far. You know, people were just skimming. And
yeah, I have a feeling it's one of those things people put on their shelves, like Power Broker, and not a lot of people actually...
Habits of Successful People, Harry Clinton's Biography, The Satanist Bible, all these just, you know, coffee table books to impress your date when they come over to your house. From my impression, like, I wasn't so bothered. I think a lot of people were focusing on the fact that Hillary Clinton owned slaves. I'm sorry, I'm doing it too. Leased slaves. and they wanted to quibble. Oh, no. Okay, no. She leased slaves. But that part didn't bother me so much as the fact that there still is slavery, modern-day slavery, under a different name, you know, which is the name of a book, Slavery by Another Name.
Yep.
And the response from liberals in trying to make this not that big of a deal.
Yes, that bothered me more than the passage. Is the terrible responses that came. Like one girl, Candace something, she's always saying, she looks like a mini-me of Hillary. But people are always retweeting her because she says crazy stuff. Like, she's like almost like a agent provocateur, because I find it hard to believe any liberal can be this liberal. It's almost like somebody created a fake parody super liberal to make liberals look bad. But she was saying stuff like, oh, have you ever seen how happy they are to get out of a cell? It gave them life skills. They could put it on their resume. She was putting all these crazy tweets with 100% sincerity.
They're just like interns. They're basically just interns. They're unpaid interns. And I know the responses, because sometimes you can just say, that's pretty messed up. It was the 80s, you know, the 1980s, not the 1880s, although it would technically have been illegal in the 1880s to have slaves. Not, you know, unless they're criminals. 13th Amendment, that's a good movie. You should probably watch it. Ava DuVernay.
Yeah, keep me.
It's all right. That's not in there. Like, if you watch the movie and you know enough about the prison industrial complex and the things, you notice there are some glaring, like, there are some really weird missing parts. You're like, oh, okay, that should probably, this thing that I know in my head should probably be in there.
And that book you mentioned, Slavery by Another Name, there's a documentary version of that book as well. So people should probably check that out. If 13th has the holes that you
say. Yeah, I mean, but people really just wanted to quibble over the definition of slavery. And I was like, once you get to the point where you're quibbling over real slavery versus fake slavery, this isn't slavery, it's just unpaid forced labor, or, you know, technically the prisoners had a choice. I'm like, oh, come on now. Like, this is, just say it's bad. And like how reactionary can you be?
Yeah, this is not a time to be pedantic. Yeah.
Like, this is nuance for the sake, like, this is nuance for the purpose of obscuring the point.
Okay, Brandon, we're closing up. I want to give you a chance to end it on whatever you want. If you want to plug something, I mean, the floor is yours.
Oh, well, I mean, thank you for having me on your show. It's been a lovely time. I really enjoyed speaking to you. Hopefully you can come on my show one day and we'll talk about something else.
I'm not going there.
No, that's fine. I understand. If it wasn't my show, I wouldn't be on it either. I wouldn't be caught dead on it either. It's trash.
But seriously, yeah, for sure. You know, just let me know when.
This is the Fast 8 of podcast, a political podcast. So thank you for having me on. Again, I'm Brandon Sutton. I am the host in... MC of The Discourse, which you can find at soundcloud.com/.
And all jokes aside, The Discourse is really good. I listened to it before having Brandon on, and it's good stuff.
He literally told me if it wasn't good, he wouldn't have me on. And I was like,
yeah, I did. I really said that too.
But no, you can find it on, you know, soundcloud.com/expanded discourse. You can find some of my writing on the Progressive Army under my name, which is, you know, Brandon Sutton, S-U-T-T-O-N. And I guess that's all I have to say on the way out.
All right, great. So good having you, Brandon, and we'll talk soon. Look forward to being on the show. All right, take care, guys. Bye.